Hello and welcome to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, brought to you by Healthful Living, healthfullivingsf.com. This is our weekly radio show, Reality Sandwich, where every week we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, the planet, and just other insightful, wonderful peekings into our collective reality. A couple of quick announcements before we jump into today's show. Just wanted to send out a quick update from one of our past guests. Micro Pixie has an album coming out. We've played a few of her cuts throughout the show over the past few months, and you can check it out at aliceinstevieWonderland.com. aliceinstevieWonderland.com. Micro Pixie's music is very meditative and introspective, and I highly recommend that you check out her new CD. And also, next week on the show, Julie will be interviewing Susan Senator, author of Making Peace with Autism, on her continuing series and peeks into her work with autism. But bringing me right back to today, I am excited to be here with Reality Sandwich co-host Jason McLean. How's it going, Jason?
Oh, it's going excellent, Martin.
Great to be back here with you, and you have connected us with another wonderful guest, Adam Kutz. Am I pronouncing it correct, Adam? Are you? Do I have your mic on properly?
I don't know.
Oh, there you are. Okay, great.
There we are.
Great. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Adam is in his fourth year of teaching meditation in an eight-week class format, and he's been practicing daily meditation for 16 years, and he's lived in a Zen monk for several years and done dozens of meditation retreats.
Literally dozens.
Literally dozens, both in Zen and Theravada.
Correct.
Help me with the pronunciation. And Vipassana traditions. He loves to meditate, loves to teach meditation, and he loves to share the gifts that he's received from meditation practice.
All true.
I welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much.
Your website is intromeditation.com?
Correct. intromeditation.com.
This is a wonderful subject to speak about. I am a hypnotherapist, so I've been learning myself and teaching others to slow down. And many people have asked me, you know, what's the difference between, you know, self-guided meditation or self-hypnosis and meditation? What are the differences? How do I learn to do one or the other? And I've always wanted to learn more. And I have practiced some meditation here and there. I've been to the Zazen Center once or twice. I've tried it once or twice. I've stopped. I haven't really taken a class, so I'm really curious to hear your insights and explanations for myself, and then myself as a proxy for our listenership to learn as much as we can about meditation and how it can benefit us in our lives.
Excellent. Well, hopefully the show will be valuable for you and for all of our listeners.
So where should we begin? We were just chatting, and you were saying that we wanted to just kind of start off, actually maybe as people are listening in, maybe begin or guide folks through some experience, some process?
Yeah, let's start with a short meditation just to give people an experiential experience of what we're going to be talking about. We'll make this short. We'll make it 5 minutes. I know some people might be at work. Some, you know, if you're driving or chopping vegetables or about to go to a meeting, you might want to not really follow my instructions too closely. But if you can, take some time. 5 minutes here, if you're at home or at your desk at work, then let's do it.
Okay, should we just jump in, or should we? Part of me is feeling like we should talk about, like, what is meditation? Do people know?
You know, I'd rather talk about that after we do 5 minutes of it, and that's probably the best way for anyone who hasn't meditated, or even people who have, to really ground themselves in the answers to some of those questions.
Okay.
So what I would ask is that people find a place where they can sit solidly. Try and have both feet on the ground if you're sitting in a chair. Try and sit up as straight as possible. And let's start by taking three intentional deep breaths as a way of taking a transition from our usual everyday mind that's trying to make it, that's trying to get ahead, that's trying to ensure our survival, into the world of intentional spiritual practice, intentional connecting with the divine. And when you're done taking your three breaths, bring the front of your spine up towards your head, the back of your spine down towards your tail. consciously extend your spine. The most important part of posture in meditation is an extended spine. See if you can bring your shoulder blades down your back if you're in a sitting position. See if you can envision the bottoms of your shoulder blades meeting at the bottom of your back. See if you can create a little bit of space between the top of your spine and your skull. See if you can lift up with the top of your skull, the very crown of your skull. When you've done that, see if there's any tension or holding, any tightness in your face, in your shoulders, in your jaw, in your eyes. Intentionally breathe awareness, breathe some love into those areas on an inhale. On an exhale, let that tension drain out. Just let it drain out into the air. On an inhale, any tension or holding or tightness that you find in your chest, in your shoulders, in your arms. On an inhale, breathe some awareness into any of that tension. On the exhale, just let it drain out of you, out into the air. On an inhale, bring awareness to your hips, your lower body, your belly, your legs. On an inhale, any tension that you feel, be aware of it, bring awareness, bring some love to it. And exhale, just let it drain out of you. A lot of people want meditation to relax them, but sometimes bringing relaxation, intentionally relaxing at the start of a meditation, is really the best way to go deeper right from the outset. So when you're done with that, bring your awareness to your breath. Some schools of Buddhism recommend bring your awareness to your breath in the rings of your nostrils, the very spot where air leaves the outside world and enters your internal world, and where the exhale leaves you and rejoins the outside world. So that's one spot. Another spot is two or three finger widths below the belly, called the hara in Japanese. So bring your awareness to one of those spots. Please pick one spot and stick with it. So what do you feel there right now? A lot of people report that on the inhale and exhale, things are a little more interesting. There's something happening. And then between breaths, it's a little harder to keep their awareness there. But even when things aren't quite as scintillating, bring your awareness back to the spot that you've picked. What do you feel there? What's happening there right now? If you bring your full awareness there, you'll find that there's slight little tingles. There's often temperature, some hot, some cold, some pressure, some muscular tension, some muscular release. There's usually something happening. As a matter of fact, in every little part of our experience, every single thing we look at, every single step that we take, the sensations in the soles of our feet, and definitely with every breath we take, there's whole galaxies of sensations. It's just a matter of the subtleties of our mind. Getting close enough to really, getting intimate enough with the experience to really see how much richness of perception there is available. So in the spot that you've picked of your respiration, bring your awareness there. Feel how much subtlety of sensation you can be aware of right now. Getting out of your ideas about what it is, what the breath is. Really experience it right now. Have a lived experience. One philosopher said, "Life is washed in the speechless real." What's the speechless real of your breath right now? You may notice that 1,001 things are pulling you away. Thoughts about what you have to do, how long will this go on, what does this mean, what does this have to do about meditation. Maybe your body has some slight pains or some itches, wants to move. Let that all slide away. One Zen master talked about body and mind dropping away. Let those all drop away from the central point of your respiration. Just know that you'll take care of them all. Bring your awareness simply back to your respiration, in and out. Just a simple swinging door. Bring your awareness always back to the present moment, to what's happening right now. It's easy to get caught in the present, future and the past. But as spiritual teachers say, the future and past are creations of the mind. You can't find them, because all there is the right now, and all there is in your breath is the right now. Bring your awareness back to the breath right now, keeping your spine straight, your chest open, and then as much as possible, relaxing your body and letting go of awareness of it. Bring your attention back to your breath. A lot of times breath meditation, it's like digging a ditch. It's simple manual labor. Your mind wants to wander away. You want to move. You want to think about something else. And you just keep bringing your breath back, like simply digging a ditch. It's just simple labor. Your mind wanders away a million times. You bring it back a million and one times. You keep coming back to the breath. So now we're going to expand that meditation a little bit, include body sensations. So if your mind gets drawn to your breath, that's fine. But if it gets drawn anywhere else in your body, bring your awareness to that. Let your body just be natural. Let it be however it is. Let yourself feel whatever you do. You know, you might be feeling your butt on the chair. You might be feeling the air in the room. You might be feeling your clothes, your watch. You might be feeling emotions. You feel your heartbeat. You might feel hunger. You might feel fullness if you just ate lunch. Whatever you feel is perfect. Don't try and change it. You know, you might be feeling the breath. Bring your attention to wherever in your body you feel sensation. Wherever in your body, bring your full awareness there and let your awareness sink into that spot like water into a sponge. You might have thoughts. You might, when I just said water into a sponge, you might have a visual of a water going into a sponge. Just let your thoughts go. You might have analysis. Well, you know, I heard about meditation, and this is how this, what we're doing right now, fits in. It's kind of Vipassana meditation. Just try and let go of that, too. Just bring your awareness back to your body, to the simple rhythm of sensations in your body. A lot of people find when they really tune into body sensations that there's kind of a vibratoriness to them, or, you know, there's different vibrations to a given body sensation. You stub your toe, and there's a fast vibration of pain and a slow vibration of pain. So try and tune into where in your body, where do you feel the vibrations? If your awareness is drawn to a certain spot in the body, just stay there for a little while. And if it gets drawn to a different part of the body, bring your awareness there. There's no right or wrong to how fast your awareness should move or how long you should stick with some spot. Just wherever you're drawn in your body, gently be there. Try to open up to the sensation. Try and encounter it more intimately than you ever have before. Try to just let it be how it is without demanding that it change. If there's pain, let it be pain. If there's pleasure, let it be pleasure. If it's neither, if it's neutral, or if it's mixed, just let it be that. Bring your awareness back to how the sensations are right now and how they are right now. You could feel your whole body. Your awareness could be drawn into one tiny little spot. Doesn't matter. However your body sensations are now, try and be more aware than you usually are, and try and be more allowing than you usually are. Try and learn something a little more interesting about the way your body sensations work. And that's about it. May all beings be happy.
Well,
I'm reminded of this notion, you know, that stress and craziness will always find us, but we have to go and find relaxation.
Yes.
And we're rarely taught, you know, how to do that, how to really relax.
Yeah, the Buddha talked about his path as going upstream, swimming upstream, that life carries us downstream, and, you know, there's all the demands socially on all of us. There's all the, there's what the Buddha called karma. There's just all of our, the way our biology conditions us. There's the way that our childhood conditions us. There's the way society conditions us. There's all these ways in which we habitually act. But to turn around and actually evolve or grow as a person, to intentionally choose to be a person who's opening to life and who's opening to a deeper potential for self, that's always a choice.
So, Adam, thank you for that direct experience that we just had. And I'm curious, it seems like there's a lot of different definitions and practices for meditation. And is it more about having a clear mind? Is it about, you know, focusing on some god or goddess? Is it about being open to the universe or to the divine? What is it?
That's a great question, Jason. Thank you. I think a lot of trouble gets caused because many of the people that first translated the ancient Buddhist texts into English used traditional Western words that don't really map to Buddhist concepts super well. In Buddhist circles, you hear the word greed a lot. And I think one of my teachers talks about how even very peaceful or spiritual Buddhist teachers will use that word greed a lot. But I like what what my one teacher said, which is that the reason why that word is used a lot is because in the early 20th century, late 19th century, a lot of the early people that were translating the Buddhist words were Bible-thumping Christians, and they grew up with the seven deadly sins, and greed is one of those. So they heard a word that raga, which actually better translates to attachment, and they translated it to greed. We have this word enlightenment. You hear that a lot. That's one of the most common words that gets associated with Buddhism, enlightenment. Whereas the Sanskrit word moksha, or the Japanese word satori, which are what gets translated to enlightenment, would actually be better translated as liberation. The word enlightenment is a word from the Western philosophical tradition. And similarly, it is with meditation. Meditation is a word with many Western connotations. I think in the medieval Christian tradition, the word meditation meant to contemplate an idea. It might be something somewhat similar to the Eastern, the Hindu or Buddhist idea of meditation in terms of sort of a wordless prayer or a longing for God. But many times the word meant to kind of ruminate over an idea, like the idea that, hey, I could be a better person if I was more self-disciplined.
Like somebody meditates on something.
Yeah, and we still use that word in that way. But I think classically in the Buddhist tradition, the word means something somewhat different. I think there's some very specific technical meanings to the word. I think sometimes it's used to use something like contemplation. Like, in the Tibetan tradition, a teacher might assign you to consider the idea how attachment creates suffering. So you get into your meditation position, and you think about that. You just sort of, as we would say in the West, be with that idea for 40 minutes. There's also the idea of cultivation. You know, there's many practices in the Buddhist tradition concerning cultivation of compassion or loving kindness or joy. I think in modern California we might have meditations where you cultivate your immune system or you cultivate the perfect swing in baseball or softball. I think the way I teach meditation, I talk about it in none of those meanings. I talk about two very specific meanings that are derived from some of the earliest teachings of the Buddha.
And you are going to tell us those, right?
I'm about to.
Please. Okay, good.
We got a while here, so I'm giving some long answers here to some simple questions. If we had 10 minutes, I'd kind of bottom line it a little bit more. In any event, one of the central teachers of the Buddha was the Eight Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the last of the Four Noble Truths. So the Eightfold Path is divided into three subsections. The first one is what the Buddha called ethics, which is right livelihood, right speech, and right action. The idea there is that if you're going to take a spiritual journey, if you're going to want to be a more happier person, if you're going to want to spiritually evolve, the first step is just really taking care of the basics of your life. You know, if you want to go to a monastery and meditate a lot, and you're $100,000 in debt and people are after you, it's kind of hard to concentrate. You know, if you're drunk every night, there are some great Buddhist teachers who drank a lot, but the idea is basically take care of the basics of your life. Make sure your livelihood is something that you can be proud of and look people in the eye and be happy that you're doing. You know, under right action, he said, don't lie, don't misuse sexuality, don't abuse intoxicants. You know, being drunk every night is not conducive to the spiritual path. So that was the first step. You know, that whole area is sometimes translated as morality or ethics. I like what one of my teachers says. It's conduct compatible with enlightenment. If you think about a fully liberated being, you know, whoever your hero is, whether it's the Buddha or Jesus or Sri Ramakrishna or Gandhi or Thich Nhat Hanh or John Lennon or, you know, whoever is your embodiment of spiritual peace, think about how would he act? How would she act? How would someone that you really admire act? So that's the first step in meditation as far as I'm concerned.
Sort of a grounding or a foundation?
Exactly. Exactly. If you knew that you would have enough food for the rest of your life, if you knew that you would make it, if you knew that people loved you more than you had any idea, if you knew that great things were available in your life, that you really like some of your big hopes would come true, how would you act? You probably wouldn't act desperate. You probably wouldn't lie. You definitely wouldn't kill anyone. So the first step in meditation is to make those assumptions, you know, ground yourself in those realities and act in such a manner. The second step is concentration. It's sort of the doing of meditation.
And is what you were just talking about, the being, or am I on the wrong?
In a way, it's all doing and being. I mean, this is Asian religion we're talking about.
Right.
But I'll say that the third step is what I would call more the being. So under this, you have what the Buddha called, in the Eightfold Path, you have right effort, which is, this is so wonderful, I love this. The Buddha said, if there's something wholesome in your life that you're not doing, start doing it. If there's something wholesome in your life that you are doing, do it. Keep doing it. If there's something unwholesome in your life that you're not doing, keep not doing it. If there's something unwholesome in your life that you are doing, stop doing it. I love that.
It's pretty straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward. But, you know, it's like a lot of us don't do that. I mean, you know, I don't know anyone who lives that perfectly. So that's right effort. There's right concentration, which if you recall when we were doing the breath meditation, and I said, keep letting go of your mind getting pulled this way or that. You know, keep bringing it back to the breath. That's right concentration. And then there's right mindfulness, which, you know, I was talking about the vibrations. I was talking about where in your body do you feel things. Really open up to that. And that's mindfulness of body sensations. So all that is kind of intentionally choosing to do something with your mind. The last of the Eightfold Path is wisdom. It's insight. And under this is right thoughts and right view. These are a lot harder to talk about. You know, you talk about right concentration. It's like you choose to pay attention to the soles of your feet as you do walking meditation. You choose to feel your breath as you do breath meditation. You choose to pay attention to a mantra as you do mantra meditation. That's all pretty straightforward. You're making a choice to bring your awareness back to something again and again. You can explain that to a kid. When you start talking about right thoughts and right views, that's a lot more subtle. You're talking about very spiritual things. And I suppose I can give my best shot at talking about those. I want to go back, though, and talk a little bit more about concentration practice. There's some ancient texts that talk about Buddhist meditation is being a bird that needs two wings. And what they're talking about is insight practice and concentration practice. Is this clear enough? Is this?
I want to ask you one little piece that I think just kind of fit right in here. You mentioned liberation.
Yes, sir.
When you were speaking about enlightenment is really this notion of liberation. And I keep hearing it now about right thinking and concentration and avoiding these other thoughts that are coming. What are we speaking of when we're talking about liberation? Freedom from these other thoughts that take my mind elsewhere that doesn't serve me? Talk a little bit about liberation, what we mean by that. I mean, you also mentioned that we were coming up with a title for today's show. I think we had mentioned liberation in the context of meditation as well. So I'm curious about what are we liberating from, or is it something from ourselves, from our thoughts? What?
Yeah, great. The Buddha talked in the Second Noble Truth about typically that the source of our suffering, the thing that binds us from liberation, is within ourselves. He called it the three poisons. And the first of those poisons is attachment. It's like, you know, alcoholism being sort of a prime example of that everyone can be aware of. Overeating, someone who can't stop gambling. But, you know, for most of us, it's a little more subtle than that. We all have attachment. It's like, you know, you're talking to someone and there's something on in the, you're talking to a friend and there's something on in the television in the background and you start staring at that. Or you check your email even though you checked it 5 minutes ago. Or, you know, people sitting there in the airport and they're thinking and thinking and they got to read the paper. I think in the modern world, we all have a lot of attachment. Then there's aversion. Aversion is, you know, you see someone across the room that's your friend, and you got to clear something up with them, but, you know, the conversation would be a little difficult, so you stay away from it. Or it's procrastination is a prime form of aversion. Some people don't want to get out of bed in the morning because it's cold out, or they got to go to their job, or whatever. I mean, I think in daily life, there's hundreds of examples where people shy away from their life because they want to avoid something that's unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So concentration practice is the antidote to attachment and aversion. When we meditate, our mind gets drawn into fantasies. I mean, people have all sorts of rich fantasies where they're a billionaire, where they found their company, it works out great, or they go back last week to that argument they have and they say just the perfect thing. Those are typical things that people come up with in meditation. People want And you can see your attachment right there. People are attached to going off in these flights of reverie. And meditation concentration practice, coming back to the breath, for example, is a way of letting go of that attachment, a way of liberating ourselves from it. Then there's aversion. In meditation, if you sit still long enough, you'll have all sorts of pains come up for you. Your knees will hurt, your back will hurt. If you sit still for long enough, your whole being will hurt. Everything that you've avoided your whole life, if you sit still and relax, will come up for you. So to be willing to let that pain come, to be willing to let that wash through you, to not be scared of it, to not be overwhelmed by it, but actually to have a liberated experience of it, that's where concentration practice can help as well.
Liberation, freedom.
Exactly. In Buddhism, though, those two are seen as two branches off the central trunk. And that trunk is called, it's really hard to talk about these things, but it's called alienation from our divine self. I mean, those are my words for it. I don't think the Buddha would have put it in those words. I think it's called ignorance in Buddhist texts. And that's the central of the three poisons, is unconsciousness or ignorance of sort of our central essence. There's two ways that people get... that people fall into that ignorance. A lot of people like, I'm me, and I have this sort of bank account, and I got to fight against the world. I got to make it. You know, other people are not my friends. I mean, does that sound familiar? I think that's the way.
It's a case of mistaken identity.
Exactly.
Well, this is what we learn in our society.
Exactly.
I mean, unless we at some point connect into some really deeper spiritual connection with whatever religion we may have, we are all products of our environment in our society that we grow up in, and we've learned so much to externalize the responsibility for our own emotional and physical and really our entire well-being.
And even in some religions, even though they're deeply spiritual, our problems and the praise is all external.
Right, and the solution is external.
That's right.
As long as you keep paying.
That's right.
You can have a solution.
George Carlin.
Right?
Always needs a little more money, God. Somehow I just can't handle money.
It's George Carlin, but it's also every, I mean, all those channels you flip through. I mean, there's great stuff there, and there's wonderful messages, and I don't want to rip on anybody in particular, but I have seen, you know, some of these things recently, and they're wonderful messages about, you know, personal growth and connection to source, yet there's one little piece that's different than what really moves me personally, and what we're talking about here is the source of all of that.
Yes.
And they keep telling me that the source is somehow outside of me and through them, when what I've been digging in my own life for coming on 40 years now is that that's not true. It is within us somehow. So I love to just, you know, explore that deeper and deeper and learn my own methods of connecting into that. So
excellent.
This is what we're on about here, is that the sources of these things reside within us, which for a lot of people, I think, can be a huge awakening and also a huge source of empowerment to realize that we can actually tap it ourselves.
Yeah, it's available at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
The kingdom of God is within.
So they say.
So where does one begin? Is that a broad question?
Why is meditation? Why is there so much focusing on the breath? So. It seems to be pretty common. I've done a couple of Vipassana 10-day meditations. I've heard of other meditative practices where there's a lot of focusing on the breath. Why is that? Why is that such a common thread through meditative practice?
I think there's a lot of reasons why the breath is so common, both within the different Buddhist traditions and also in Western monotheistic religions. I think one reason is that it's free. You know, a stick of incense or a candle a villager in India might not be able to afford. It's universal. Some cultures, traditional indigenous cultures, probably had bells. Others probably didn't. But every human being has a breath. You never left it in your other pants. It's always with you. I think some other reasons are because the breath is really right at the cusp point between voluntary and involuntary. You know, there's aspects of being a human being, like whether you raise your arm or not, that are definitely voluntary. And then there's aspects like growing your hair that are involuntary. The breath kind of rides that dividing point.
Yeah, that is interesting.
The breath also, a couple other reasons, the breath is, it both can cultivate your state of mind. If you breathe long and slow and deep on purpose, it'll relax you. If you breathe short and jagged on purpose and irregularly, it'll stress you out. And similarly, those respective two types of breath, they reflect states of mind. So you can learn a lot about how your mind is, how your emotions are from watching the breath. And I think a number one reason is because the breath is both simple and dynamic. If you gave someone the meditation, some of my students do this, of just watch your whole self, just be aware of your entire thoughts, all your emotions, it's like that's a bucking bronco that throws people off right away. You know, people just go into unconsciously being themselves again. They're not meditating, they're just being themselves, which is similar but different. Whereas the breath, it's dynamic, it's always changing. Every moment it's something new, but it's basically you're breathing in, you're breathing out, or it's in between. So it's a way of getting used to the ever-changing now and the way that aspects of self are always changing, and kind of being very precise about being aware of that with your mind, getting your mind in there and kind of paying attention to that without it being too trippy and weird and too many variables to pay attention
or
to.
Or too overwhelming. I mean, observing your whole self, people may not even know what to do. Exactly. Let alone putting them off.
Yeah, so it's a really good thing for beginner meditators because it's something simple, it's something that's always changing, it's something that's always with you. It can tell you a lot about your mind, it can tell you a lot about your emotions, it can show you a lot about the way you habitually act.
Are there any... What's coming up for me is like a couple times that I've learned I had to sit in a particular way, or I had to find a really quiet space, and, you know, then I thought to myself, well, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm not always going to have that option to sit in a really beautiful little room with a candle.
You always stand on your head while you're meditating. Isn't that right?
That's what I've always heard. But I'm going to be a renegade and say, I think there's ways of preparing that definitely help meditation. You know, if you meditate with your eyes open, to have nothing in your line of sight that would be distracting. I think what I've heard many of my teachers say, and I think it's true, having an extended spine, having your spine be as straight as possible is definitely helpful. That's probably the most important thing about posture. Being comfortable, being in a position such that you can really relax your body for however long you're going to meditate, while staying alert, keeping your spine extended, that's helpful too. I think not having the phone ring or having someone dash in, those all help a person to concentrate. But ultimately, as you point to, Martin, or as you kind of hinted at, meditation is about liberation in any and all situations. And ultimately, I think the aim of meditation is to find a way to be aware and allowing, to have a liberated mind state, no matter what posture you're in, no matter what state you're in. To me, in the middle of a crowded railway station, you know, curled up because there's people on either side of you, and still to have a really great, clear mind. I think that's possible. I think it takes a lot of training. So ultimately, it's not about a certain posture. It's not about a certain set of circumstances. It's about what your consciousness brings to any and all circumstances.
And actually, the meditative state may be even more useful in high-stress situations.
Definitely. Some of my teachers talk about meditation being a vaccination. You know, we sit still and we learn to concentrate the mind, and then we learn to have insight practice where our mind really accords with exactly what's going on inside of us. And if we can do that under the controlled circumstances of, you know, a quiet room without much distraction, then eventually you can do that in the middle of, you know, police cars roaring down the street next to you, or in the middle of a fight with someone that you care about, or in the middle of trying to get a project done at work, that first we practice, and then eventually we're able to bring that freedom and that liberation into difficult circumstances.
So, you know, I'm curious, if it's all Zen, you know, it's all good, or it's all spirit manifest, you know, wherever we're at or whatever's occurring is all God or spirit manifest, why even bother with a formal meditation practice?
I think the deepest spiritual teachers have always told us it's all good, there's nothing to worry about. But at the same time, that's not our reality. I mean, if humanity blew up the planet with nuclear bombs, it's like there's a way in which the whole universe would go on spinning, it would all be perfect, but from our human point of view, that would be not so good. So I think there's a way in which we want to have our own personal experience be of liberation, of opening, of deepening. And I think meditation is a way, no matter who you are, you know, you could say in a Christian sense, God loves you. You know, it's perfect no matter what you're doing. But at the same time, for us to really have to live up to the full potential of our lives, there's definitely actions for us to take.
So it's all Zen, but we don't realize that yet. We're in this state of agitation.
Correct.
And so we take on the formal meditation practice until we realize that it's all Zen, that it's all spirit manifest.
Exactly.
We actually have that emotional experience.
Exactly. You know, the Buddha talked about it in terms of what I was saying before, the three poisons, attachment, aversion, and unconsciousness or ignorance, that we have these impurities of mind. We have these subtle tensions and holdings. You know, it's like many people have come home from a stressful day at work and their shoulders are up around their ears. Well, we have those same kind of tensions and knots that we are aware of in our upper back. We have the same ones in, you know, our psyches and our souls. And that's what meditation is about working those out. You know, in modern California, we might call these our wounds, our stuff. You know, a lot of people who have read the great spiritual traditions and they say, hey, it's all good, it's all perfect, it's all Zen. You know, you zip into the parking spot ahead of them and, well, you know, you see how all Zen it is for them. It's one thing to,
yes.
As the great Zen teacher Bodhidharma said, all know the way, but few walk it. So meditation is a way to walk it. Meditation is a way for us to realize our highest aspirations and the deepest insights that we have, or the things that really move us when we read spiritual books, but have a hard time manifesting in our daily lives.
All know the way, but few walk it.
Yep, says that on my refrigerator.
I have a very linear American kind of question.
Yes, sir.
As I've practiced, and the initial few times I was, you know, quote, learning, right? I didn't know if I was doing it. How do I know? I mean, things I've heard is that it's about having a clear mind, or, you know, having no thoughts at all, but then I'm having a thought, and then I'm wondering, you know, am I really meditating, or am I being one with everything when am I doing it right? So for folks that are maybe have some of that kind of thing going on with them, right? How do I do it? Am I doing it right? Concern coming in, as many of us do, right? That how am I going to learn this? What do you say to some of those folks, either when you're chatting with them, or maybe if they show up in one of your classes and they're just kind of beginning and they've heard that meditation can help them? They were just listening a few moments ago and you were talking about that stress and that frustration of the day and going, wow, but, you know, how do I start it? How do I do it? How do you guide those folks?
Yeah, great. A lot of questions in there, so I'll try and touch on what I remember. I think there's no real way to tell if you're meditating right in the short term. I think sometimes meditation is really blissful, and a lot of people, especially beginners, will say, oh, it's great. You know, a lot of my students come to me and they'll say, these first couple of weeks, I'm so happy. And I'll say, you just wait.
And then they're creating an attachment to some certain state.
Okay? Yeah, and there's an expectation of that. I think sometimes the openings that happen in meditation, the deepenings, the evolution that happens in meditation feels really wonderful. And there's bliss. There's the kind of things you would expect. There's a feeling of bodily well-being. You relate to people better. Other times, though, meditation can just be sheer agony. It's like being woken up an hour after you went to bed and being told you have to drive somewhere. It's that sort of feeling, just like, oh, my whole body's aching, my whole soul is aching. And that can be some of the best meditation, because one is really facing something that's difficult for one to face. Mm. So I think there's no real clear sign as to whether a meditation's a good one or not. I love what one of my teachers says. The sign that a meditation was a good one is that you did it. I think it really helps to read books and talk with teachers. I think that really helps a person to get clear on what the techniques are and what the common pitfalls are. You talked about so I think if a person's not clear about how to meditate, I think getting some basic training, and then beyond that, just doing it, just sitting there. I think a lot of the value of meditation is just sitting still for a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes I think concentration, having insight, using a technique, really practicing the way of the ancients, it's all icing on the cake compared with what really the value is, just sitting still, just doing it, just being intentional about the practice.
Now, you teach courses, right?
Yes, sir.
You have a class, I was on the website earlier, I believe, beginning in September. How many weeks is that?
It's 8 weeks. It's 3 hours a night. I typically teach two techniques a night, and we talk about all sorts of topics pertinent to a beginner and also pertinent to people who have been meditating for a while.
So I would not. I would feel just fine if I had never meditated ever in my life, had any experience, and I just showed up to this class. Because sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm gonna be in this class. Everybody else knows what they're doing. I don't know anything how to meditate.
My classes aim the aim in designing my class is for it to really resonate with different students on different levels. For beginners, I think it resonates on a certain level, and there's a lot that beginners catch towards getting established in the practice, just learning the broad parameters. And some of my students who've been meditating for a while have found it valuable in terms of learning some new techniques and really learning some of the theoretical underpinnings of some of the practices they've been doing or learning a little bit more about that. So I think there's value for people with different levels of experience, yes.
You know, I'm curious, Adam. I've heard that in Buddhist psychology, thinking can be considered just like another sense, like taste, touch, smell, hearing, feeling. Is that accurate?
That's entirely accurate. I think for some of my students, that's the biggest revelation that they've had in taking my class is that thinking isn't them. It's not like thinking is the true self and then stubbing their toe and feeling pain is just something they have. You know, you say, I have a pain, but then thinking somehow is more closely aligned with people's sense of self.
I am thinking, people say.
Yeah, exactly.
As if they are their thoughts. But are they really even their thoughts?
Buddhist psychology would say absolutely not. That many of our thoughts are just accidents of our upbringing or our biology or just our circumstances. And that as much as we watch the breath, there was a watching of body sensations in the meditation that we did, we can do the same thing with our thoughts. There's a simile in a lot of Buddhist poems, an image of clouds in the sky. We aim to, instead of, you know, if you're flying in a plane and you're in a cloud bank and all you can see is the clouds, then they seem very solid and very real. Whereas if you see a whole lot of blue sky around a cloud, then it doesn't seem as heavy and serious. And so we try and create some blue sky around our thoughts and realize they're the most ephemeral things in the universe.
I heard once that vipassana actually means seeing things as they truly are.
Yes.
It's like the sun is always there, but sometimes there's clouds, and then we think, oh, there's no sun. Except the sun is always there above the clouds.
Yeah. One thing I've learned on the spiritual path is that life is impossibly miraculous. You know, modern physics tells us that the matter that we experience is energy that's blinking in and out of existence at this infinitesimally rapid pace, and that it's all coming from nothingness into somethingness and back into nothingness, which is pretty much the way the Buddha talked about that. And the whole experience is just this marvelous, amazing thing, and it's so amazing to be born a human being and be able to be conscious of this whole process going on. And the more our minds can accord with that, the more we can get out of that root poison of unconsciousness and really have our minds accord with what is it beyond our very limited, narrow experience of being human? What is the impossible miracle of just having body sensations, just having thoughts? These are messengers from the source of it all coming to us at every moment. If we can feel that we're a finite fragment of the infinite, then I forgot what your question was. I just like talking about these things.
Me too, but I have another one now.
All right.
I'm curious. You said unconsciousness a few times.
Yes.
But I'm unclear what you mean when you say that. I think in the West, people think, oh, I'm asleep.
Yes.
Is it like that, like, you know, people walking around in a daze, or is it just how much you're taking into your view, your worldview?
Yes.
Or
I think there's a lot of different ways I could answer that question. I think the way I've been using the word unconsciousness is the root poison. It's in the ancient Indian language, it was called moha. And this is seen as the source of all of our suffering, according to the Buddha. And again, it's either having the narrow, tight focus on self, which many people have, most of us have a lot of the time.
Egocentric or ethnocentric. Even.
Yeah, yeah, like me against the world or my people against the world, I got to fight. Or then you know how some people get annoyingly New Agey and they're like, it's all good, nothing matters.
Right.
Like I didn't get out of bed today, but it's all perfect. I'm all merged with, it's all God. And like, that's the other way to fall off of that. You know, that's obviously a little that's off
kind
as well.
Kind of a gross overgeneralization.
Exactly.
I'm one with all things.
Yeah. I mean, we are one with all things, and we are an individual self that needs to eat, that needs to, you know, go do our job and breathe.
Both
and
are true. Yeah.
Blow our nose when it's stuffed up. So I think finding that middle point where we realize that we are a finite fragment of the infinite. We're not just the infinite, and we're not just a finite fragment. We're the meeting point of the two. That's when our unconsciousness dissolves. That's when the moha dissolves. So
when we realize that, or when we see
when we
that,
have the direct lived experience of that.
The direct lived experience.
Yeah.
So often, you know, gee, if nothing bothers me, will I become passive and just be a doormat if I take on a formal meditation practice and actually become, a good Buddhist?
Yes. Will you just be a bump on the log, a sack of potatoes that people can kick around?
That's right.
One of my great teachers talks about the number one stumbling block in meditation is knowing what to do and not doing it. The number two is fear of becoming passive. That's something that stops a lot of people. I think the fundamental error there is the difference between being absolutely internally allowing and being externally allowing. I think the essence of meditation is being aware and allowing. It's being a lot more aware than we usually are. Like, you know, when we did that meditation at the beginning on the breath, weren't you more aware of the breath than usually are? Weren't you more aware of the body sensations?
Yes.
But a lot of people, they're able to be aware of themselves, and once they start to be aware of themselves, they pick at themselves. You know, like cutting a cuticle till it bleeds. They start being like, wow, I'm really dishonest with people. And they get really hard on themselves. Whereas a lot of people can be relaxed and allowing. They can drink a beer and watch TV and feel great without being very aware. The trick with meditation is to really balance the two, to really get in there and do both. So a lot of people mistake that allowing that we have in meditation, that real relaxation and gentleness with just accepting anything in the world. Like, if I accept the present moment, if I accept all the energies within me as being exactly what they are, then I won't have any motivation to change anything.
And in others, right? I mean, the concern that comes up for me is in terms – I've noticed in my own work as an evolutionary guide, there's a lot of people who either draw boundaries abruptly or inappropriately or not at all when they know
exactly.
Internally they need to. And I think that evolves depending on their own stage of development, of course, where they need to draw boundaries. I'm concerned about people taking on meditation practice thinking they shouldn't draw boundaries appropriately, not honoring themselves, and then they experience greater internal dissonance that they have to work through.
That is a stage that some people get to. They start getting into that allowing part of meditation, and some people do get very groovy, kind of passive. And I'm a great believer in meditation practice. I'm a great believer that works itself out. I think you're talking about drawing boundaries, you know, as a social activity between people. To my mind, that's a perfect place to talk about that meeting point between being a finite fragment and the infinite, the meeting point between being passive and being active. And I think meditation really helps us find that meeting point. I think in the long term, it doesn't make people passive, and it doesn't make people hyper or active. It makes people, as they say in Zen, an appropriate response. It helps people find the amount of action that's appropriate without overdoing it or engaging in activity that's kind of fruitless.
Mm. That brings me back to that notion of liberation and freedom.
Yeah.
Libre from liberation, balance. Right,
great.
And finding the balance in all of this. In our last couple of moments, because our time just flew by, we
it
could
did.
Clearly just talk on the subject for hours. But in the last just couple of minutes, if you could just talk a little bit about how people can get going, and like how much time would it sort of take on their daily basis.
Well, what I say to people first off is, I think meditation is a great practice, and if you're not suffering, there's no need to take it on. You know, some people are like, oh, I should meditate, or I'd love to, but I don't have the time. And I say to people, if your life's working for you, great.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I have such a short attention span that for me, meditation is an absolute necessity in my life. And I encounter more and more people who find for themselves that once they really start engaging it, it really does become a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're talking about people who have come to that realization and who really are like, hey, I want to get going. I want to start with this. I think meditating 5 minutes once a week is a lot better than nothing. If a person just wants to sit down, there's a lot of resources there how to learn. If a person just wants to sit down and start, that's great. I think as much time as a person can put into it, that's even better. I think there's a lot of teachers out there, especially here in the Bay Area. On my website, there's a page called Resources. I have a click-through to every Buddhist center I'm aware of in Northern California.
And again, that's intromeditation.com.
Intromeditation.com, I-N-T-R-O-meditation.com. So I think the best way is just, you know, once you realize that it's something you want in your life, just sit down and start doing it. If you if you're looking for a teacher, there's a lot out there. And I think going to my website, you can find one that's geographically close to you. I think there's a lot of really great books. I have some book recommendations on my website. And I'm a great believer in my course as well. And I'll be starting one on Monday night, starting September 19th in the Bernal Heights part of San Francisco.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. It's
we've been speaking today on Reality Sandwich with Adam Kutz, and you can catch him at intromeditation.com. And once again, we find that profound change in our life is possible, and all we need to do is to begin. Just begin. Jason, thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Again, my name is Jason McClain. I'm an evolutionary guide. If you're looking to accelerate your evolution, you can reach me through emotionalawareness.com.
Thank you. I am Martin Matthews. I am a certified medical hypnotherapist, healthful living advocate. You can find information on myself or Julie Matthews, my co-host and founding co-host of Reality Sandwich, at healthfullivingsf.com. Julie will be on the show next week, and then we're off to Burning Man, where the theme this year is psyche. Very appropriate. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week. You're listening to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO San Francisco.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That's from the now sound of today. What's going on? I know you know that by now.